You're listening to Don't Waste Water.
I'd made a lot of mistakes when starting off the company. That cost me dearly. I owned the previous company before where it was pretty easy. I flipped in 3 years. I thought, Swirltex, this is going to be even easier. This is a great idea. 5 years, I'm going to be on a beach sipping coconuts and my life's set. I literally had that thought in my head. It was the elections in 2016 where the markets crashed. After the election, I ended up being penniless afterwards. I was actually homeless. Things were like really, really bad. I went from being super comfortable to like things were so bad. I was stealing food. Just the bottom of my life.
Hello, bonjour, and welcome to the Don't Waste Water podcast.
I'm actually really close with my investors just because my life was in such dire situation when we did this CDL. Like I was sleeping on a friend's couch and people still put the faith to invest in me. And I'm the type of person where, you know, I'm showing an ounce of kindness and I take it to heart.
I'm your host, Antoine Valter, and in today's episode, I'm delighted to welcome Peter Christou as my guest.
I always say that being an entrepreneur is like running a marathon where you don't know where the end's going to be. And it sucks your energy, it sucks your stamina, it sucks your money, your livelihood. Don't get a girlfriend. But the thing is, you can't concentrate on running and you can't concentrate on the finish line. Instead, you just have to enjoy the process and enjoy that you're going for a run.
Peter is the president and founder of Swirltex.
Entrepreneurs need those wins every once in a while. And when we started up the system, and this is the first one we started up at this size, and the math was dead on. Sometimes things don't work out when you kind of go to site. The fact that it did on this one on the first go, it was a good feeling. It almost brought me to tears on site where I was like, okay, you know, we're there sort of thing.
Swirltex manages challenging waste streams to produce high quality permeate at higher throughput, lower energy consumption, and in a broader range of climates. Did the apple really fall on Newton's head? Who knows? Nobody, I guess. Yet the legend says that's how he discovered gravity. Several centuries later, Alexander Fleming accidentally contaminated a petri dish with penicillium mold. As it killed bacteria, the antibiotics were born. The story repeats with Percy Spencer that noticed that a candy bar was melting in his pocket while working on radar technology. Put that in a box and you've got a microwave. That scheme replicates in human and science history with vulcanized rubber, X-rays, pacemakers, Viagra, or even the now kind of sensitive topic of Teflon, or the much lighter one of sticky notes. Well, today's story with Swirltex actually belongs to that legacy. Would Swirltex even exist if Peter had never tried to mitigate his wastewater treatment experiments' odors in his garage? Probably not, but he'll recall the story much better than me. Before that, you'll learn what buoyancy means, how to pronounce it assuming you're not a stupid French host, and what it delivers applied to water endeavors. We'll discuss membrane systems that succeed where membranes usually fail, what it takes to bring a water tech to market, the hardships of water entrepreneurship as well, culture, execution, impact, and why, if you're a senior process engineer, you really should listen until the end.
I would give a kidney for a senior process engineer. I'll be on the record for that.
I thought we were paying with money in the sector, but now we're paying with kidneys. That's where we are.
You'll get money too. But anything I can do to get one at this point in time.
Before we start, let me remind you that if you like what you hear, all I ask is that you take this episode and share it with a colleague, a friend, your boss or your team. Check on your favorite podcatcher that you're subscribed to the podcast. That's 100% free, but not free of value. And I'll meet you on the other side. Hi, Peter. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I looked up your tech, and on one hand, I'm like, oh, that's incredibly brilliant. And on the other hand, I'm like, does that thing work? And on the third hand, I'm like, oh, I think I don't understand physics. So I'm super pumped up about that conversation. I'm wondering, as you're trying to disrupt the membrane market and come with a differentiated take with Swirltex, what are these applications where conventional membranes fail and why do they fail?
Some of the applications where conventional membranes fail is applications with high oil and grease loading and applications with high colloidals where you have these really fine dust particles, which really lend to caking of the membranes, which is a big bane of the industry. what we did with Swirltex is, at the time, the doctrine in the industry was to try to make the membrane out of different materials to reject oil. And I was working with ceramic membranes specifically for oil water separation. And it was a soul sucking experience because nothing ever worked the way that it was supposed to work. We weren't getting full recovery off of queen. The time that I was taking queen, it was just horrific. And it was just really bothering me that it wasn't working properly. And instead of changing the membrane, I thought, could we change the hydraulics on the membrane to make sure that oil doesn't interact with the membrane? And that was the start of a little bit of crazy research and development in my garage that sparked Swirltex.
We'll go into the garage story, but first I need to ask you, why do you hate me?
I don't hate you at all.
If you're French and you need to have, as the second question of your interview, what is buoyancy? Sorry, can you pick a word I can pronounce? but seriously, what is buoyancy?
It's the force applied to an object in a gas or a fluid. So it really depends upon what that density of that object is or how we manipulated the buoyancy.
And how do you manipulate it?
Buoyancy manipulation has been used in the industry for many, many years. And we see it all the time with diffused air flotation. For us, we inject air at a higher pressure than the water pressure, a lot higher, in a fine stream. And then we compress that air and we have to mix it in order for it to hit the membrane at an even mixture. One of the R&D issues that we had, especially around buoyancy, is we have a mixture of almost 50% air and liquid, which isn't really done in our industry at all. And to have that mixture, an even mixture when it hits your membranes, and to have that bubble attachment to those contaminants, was a big part of our R&D to really make the process work.
So that's the part where I swiftly mentioned that I'm reaching the limits of my understanding of physics. Because roughly speaking, and from the great, by the way, infographics and videos which you have on your website, I understand this vortex element, this circulation, which drives water on the outer end and hence in the contact with the membrane and keeps the particles in the center. And my understanding of physics means that if whatever you try to separate has a lower density than water, then that makes absolutely sense. But what happens if your contaminants have a higher density than water? Wouldn't they be then ejected further than water and then be in contact with the membrane?
For instance, if we're pumping just straight grit, like heavy grit, which never really happens, we can't make straight grit float. We can really can't manipulate its buoyancy. So that would be directly against the membranes. One of the biggest differences in the hydraulic regime between what we're doing in our process towards normal membrane is the fact that our tangential flow is spiral within that membrane. So all our force and our shear force is actually on the face of the membrane. This eliminates the polarization layer around the membrane and other things that really affect the overall flux and fouling rates as well. So we're not getting 100% of the contaminants in the center of the membrane, but we are vastly reducing the key contaminants that interact with the membrane while making sure that our velocity on our membrane is directly on the face of the membrane. So it was a way of reducing the interaction of the main contaminants with the membrane and really concentrating our velocity on the face of the membrane. What we call direct cross flow, where we have the same velocity within our membrane where it's 4 meters per second, but we have 10 times the shear force that we would normally have within a membrane with just the parallel flow. So it really makes a difference on the overall performance of the membrane.
You touched very rapidly on two perks, I guess, of Swirltex. So if I got it right, tell me, it's higher flux and reduced fouling. Do yes. I get those two right?
No, it's reduced flux, higher fouling, and a lot less energy. We use 70% less energy than a typical tubular membrane. And the easy way to explain this is it's pretty much almost a 50% mixture of air and water. Because air is so much cheaper to pump in, it really displaces that water. Normally in a pressurized membrane, you can't pump pressurized air in because that when that pressurized air touches the membrane, it can go through the membrane much faster than the liquid can. Because we have what's called an annular flow where we have air on the inside of the membrane and the water rotates around it, it really solves that issue. It increases the hydraulic capacity and really speeds up that water. So it really increases the velocity of the water. So it really changes the way the membrane works and then the flux and fouling characteristics.
So before we go into the full story, what's the elevator pitch to Swirltex?
We've tried to stay out of traditional membrane applications. When I say that, it's hard to get into the municipal market where you have incumbent favorites. What we've tried to do is we've used membranes in areas like produced water treatment, mining, food and beverage where membranes really haven't been successful. And those have been the easiest applications for us. For instance, for mining, where we can easily filter these colloidal solutions of coal or clay and still have a flux of well over 150 or 180 LMH stabilized. So it opens markets that haven't been available to membranes before.
It opens the markets on the promise that you can make membranes work, or on the promise of your lower cost, better energy or stuff like that. What's the USP?
That the membranes will work, that you'll have that clean, consistent, high quality effluent that wasn't available to you before. When you're still using technologies like clarifiers and stuff to really make sure that your environmental compliance, clarifiers and things like that are susceptible to upsets. And that's really why a lot of the municipal industry went to membranes, because it's a clear, clean, high quality effluent as a constant. And now these other industries are enjoying that environmental certainty that you get from using membranes as well.
So it's a reuse play. You're enabling reuse in those industries.
And not just reuse. We always pitch to have reuse, whether they use that water for other industrial purposes or they just find use for it within their site. But a lot of our jobs have been just in that environmental compliance play to make sure that under tight environmental regulations that they're going to hit it. They have that guarantee to hit it and that they're not going to have upsets with their clarifier, or it's not up to the operator's skill to make sure the chemicals are balanced out, etc.
Let's go back to your story and to the roots of the company. It would be the typical Silicon Valley story, because you start out of a garage, except your garage is not in the Silicon Valley, but it's in Edmonton. So what's the story of that garage and what did you test out at the time?
Oh, I wish it was a typical Silicon Valley story. It's been an absolute crazy story. I started off Swirltex, didn't really thinking much of it. As soon as I started doing some testing in my garage, I saw that it made a lot of small difference. It was a really significant difference. So I filed a patent and I didn't really think much of it. But when I got the opportunity to test the process in Antarctica, I was a little bit excited about that. I didn't know if it was going to work or not. We were still super early stages of it. And having an opportunity like that was a bit of a stretch. But traveled down there and we're short on time. I didn't think that we'd do it. But the actual process worked not just a little bit good, but really, 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 really well. And we were able to hit our nutrient removal targets that we were looking at. One of the problems with Antarctica at that particular base is it's really high in elevation, 3,800 meters. So typical aeration is very, very difficult, especially with the amount of energy that you need to really kind of break down the contaminants. But because we're a bit of a side stream aeration where we're injecting the air under pressure, and we're running our system in what's called an open loop where all of our concentrate goes back to our tank. That dissolved oxygen that we're injecting under pressure transfers over to the tank at a lot higher rates. So that was a way that we kind of solved that high elevation issue, which is making sure that we're injecting air under pressure in front of the membrane. So it was a big win. I didn't really think much of it, but as soon as we got back to Canada, we got absolute tons of press, and that's when the real story kind of started.
But you went very fast to that first step. I want to understand what's happening before, because you're in that garage. If I'm right, you're playing with your daughters in that garage. What gets you the nudge to thinking, oh, that water should be spinning?
I just want to keep the oil from contacting the membrane, and I'm not in a position to try different membranes or try to coat the membranes or anything like that. So using hydraulics was just a way to draw the oil to the center. What I didn't really understand at the time was the difference in having that tangential cross flow or that spiral cross flow on the membrane and how that overall affected the performance. As soon as I combined the two, and then as soon as I added air, and I added air by accident, it really, like, it was immediate. It wasn't like, oh, it's a 10% increase. It was a huge increase in flux and performance. And the funny story about adding air, I was using sewage once a week and then running these experiments in my garage, and it stunk so bad that my girlfriend at the time would just yell at me for hours afterwards. So I had to try to sneak these jobs in when she left for a few hours. And I thought, okay, I better try to introduce air to this to try to make it not stink as much. So I put a venturi in front of the membrane to try to introduce some air. And as soon as I did that, I didn't understand what was going on. I was like, why do I have a breakthrough on my membrane? What's going on here? And then as soon as I saw the waste in the bucket and everything was floating like a thick mat, I was like, oh, so that's what's happening on the membranes when we're spinning it as well. We're manipulating those contaminants even more by using the air. And that's really when things took off for us.
The second thing I'd like to understand before you go into Antarctica is, actually, if I had a technology which I just invented and patented, I guess the first place I'd go is not the most remote on Earth, but it's the coldest, and where if you have a spare part missing, then it's a trouble. So how do you end up thinking, oh, that's the way I need to go?
I've been down to Antarctica before for the US program, and I specialize in cold weather infrastructure. Spent a lot of time in Canada's north, you know, all over the world, Alaska, Russia, Greenland. I knew that there was an issue there at the site. And when I went to France to go pitch the idea, I didn't know 100% that it was going to work. It was kind of a bit of a long shot, but from an operational perspective, I really knew what the issues were. So I wanted to definitely take a stab on it. And when they gave me that opportunity, I'm glad it worked out, to say the least.
So you're coming back from Antarctica. You've proven that the technology works, but now you need to, I guess, create a path to make it a business. We explained the technology, roughly how it works, but if you want to turn that into a business, it needs to have a beginning and an end. So what is the scope of what you wanted to deliver in the first place, and has that evolved over time?
It definitely evolved over time. When I had my eureka moment, I thought we'd be using the process a lot on more industrial applications, things like solvent extraction, etc. And where we really kind of ended up is making sure that we have a membrane manufacturer that can make the membranes to our spec instead of making them ourselves, cut costs, faster path, and make sure that the technology can work on standardized membranes that are available in the market. That was the tricky part. Trying to say, okay, we have an idea. We know that it works. Let's try to use membranes that are already on the market so we can show the improvement, and it's a lot easier path to the market.
But so what are you actually marketing today? Is it the system? Is it the process? Is it a license? How do you do that?
Right now, we're doing the full project. So especially since we're using a new process, it's important for us to really kind of prove out the technology in that market. But because we're such a small company, we're really now trying to find channel partners that would pair with us to help us out with everything else around the membranes. There's a lot of auxiliary equipment, et cetera, tanks, the rest of it. It's a lot faster and easier to produce the membrane skids over and over. It's relatively the same to O&M, E&M partners around the country that can use the membranes in the designated markets than us trying to go and do all the projects ourselves. So that's really where we've evolved to today.
At the beginning, I guess you had to pick a battle, and you explained how the first idea was to refrain oil from coming in contact with the membrane. So I would expect that the first vertical you go after is oil and gas. Am I right?
Sometimes, yes. Oil and gas is like dating a manic depressive. It's hot one minute and then it's not the next. So it's very hard, especially as a startup, to build your business upon projects that can be delayed, that can go. You need something that's a lot more dependable. So we did definitely go into the oil and gas side of it, but knowing that is one market that we have, it's not the only market that we have. And that was very important for our business.
So do you try to diversify in order to not depend on the, how do you call them, manic depressive that oil and gas is?
I'm going to get in trouble for that one. But yeah, I think you have to. We understand that the more markets that the membranes are applicable to, the higher the value of the process will be. The only problem is we can get really squirrely and concentrate on everything within the industry. Instead, we're saying pick 3 or 4 main markets, execute them well. One that it's really executed well and established, moved on to a different market. And that's really the strategy that we took for this approach.
In terms of membranes, would you be membrane agnostic? How does that work?
They'll need to be tubular membranes. We have 2 membrane manufacturers that make them for us to our specs. We don't need, like, we can use any tubular membrane. It's just we have a relationship with our 2 manufacturers and we're probably sticking to it. But it doesn't really matter. We can use a ceramic membrane. It just needs to be a tubular membrane.
And just because Jim Lurie might be listening to that episode at some point, is the venturi something important and you pick something specific, or is it agnostic?
We don't use a venturi in our aeration anymore. I think the only thing that is really kind of important to us that kind of goes with the technology is the membranes. We use 1 meter membranes. We don't use 2 or 4 meter long membranes. This really, really helps us for maintenance, logistics, getting them to site, etc. And it really ensures that we have a fairly even swirl pattern down the length of our membranes. So it's a completely different configuration than what you normally see in tubular membranes. And that really came from the operations perspective, where we've changed so many things on the configuration of the membranes to really make it a lot easier for the operators as well.
You mentioned the Antarctica project, but tell me about your first continental traditional project and what you learned on that one.
Oh, that was a fun one. We did a pilot in 2019, like right at the heart of COVID, for ARC Resources on a produced water job. And produced water is not where membranes go to be successful. It's usually where they go to die. So I'm having a small fit thinking, okay, let's see what we can do. And it was kind of funny because produced water really wasn't difficult at all. I had some experience with it, but
I don't want to cut you, but just to clarify that one for the muggles out there, which I might belong to, produced water is the water which comes with the drilling of oil and gas. So the water which comes with the oil and which you have to clean.
Correct. So there's a lot of water that comes up with the oil. It's really salty. It's almost in the formation that we're working in. It's well over 20% salt by content. So usually scaling and other things have issues. The other issue that comes with that is there's other chemicals that can come up with that water that have been known to foul membranes. So it's really understanding what chemicals they're using when they're breaking the formation on frac and what is actually coming up with you. As soon as you know that, it becomes a lot easier to design treatment techniques around what's happening.
On that first project, you said it was a funny story. So I expect that you have some hiccups. I'm not hoping for you to have hiccups, but what goes wrong?
There were a lot of hiccups because that was the first kind of commercial pilot that we had. You know, we had everything wrong from like pumps breaking to chemicals not kind of doing what we thought they would and the rest of it. I used to do consulting and commissioning professionally, and this was probably one of the more difficult pilots that I had. Not because of the membrane, probably because all the auxiliary equipment around it was constantly not working the way that it should. But that pilot led to the bigger system, the 3,000 cubic meter a day produced water system, which is North America's largest membrane produced water plant. So it was a big achievement to show that you could recycle this water, and you can. It's definitely not that difficult. And it really set a precedence for the oil and gas water recycling in Northern Canada.
That's the thing I wanted to underline here, which is, you know, there's this saying that pilots never fail and pilots never scale. And you broke the curse because 2019, so in the middle of probably the worst time to start a business, you do that pilot, you have some hiccups, as any pilot would have, but your full scale is from 2022, so 3 years down the line, your 10x your revenue. So it's a success story.
Yeah, no, I'll take it as a success story. Sounds good. It was such a good feeling. Entrepreneurs need those wins every once in a while. And when we started up the system, and this is the first one we started up at this size, and the math was dead on as far as like the pressure loss across the membranes and operational aspects. I've worked on membrane systems where, you know, installed 6 of them, and sometimes things don't work out when you kind of go to site. The fact that it did on this one on the first go was, yeah, it was a good feeling. It almost brought me to tears on site where I was like, okay, you know, we're there sort of thing. It's really important to be able to have those type of projects where you have those big wins that's kind of set the precedent for the configuration, what you need to do for all your other projects as well.
So you have more projects in produced water, or do you look across different sectors for the next ones?
Definitely looking across different sectors. We have a large food and beverage project happening right now. And then we have another large project in Pennsylvania that are two very difficult mediums. One's a lot of oil and grease and coal wastewater in it. And the other one's just really, really heavy oil and grease, which have been some of the easier applications for us. What we've done is we've taken difficult applications for membranes, but we haven't really stretched it. We're not doing landfill leachate and other things like that. We're doing mediums that when we test that liquid in the lab, it's fairly easy for us. We get very good results for an extended testing to make sure that we're going to be successful in the application as well.
I have one last question on the application part, which is that I couldn't help but notice on your website that you're mentioning you're working on lithium. Mm-hmm. Do you have a specific project where you're applying your membrane?
Yes. Yes, we do. We have about two or three lithium providers, especially there in Northern Canada, that we've been working with specifically. Two very different processes, we'll say, to say the least, but very good results on both. The lithium water is very similar to produced water, same like iron, residual oils, and the rest of it, where it was a lot easier to treat than the normal produced water because it doesn't have the same chemicals that the oil and gas industry can kind of pump down the hole. So for us, it was kind of like, okay, but let's do this. And we're definitely on the forefront for filtration within Western Canada, for sure.
Can you name the companies you're working with?
E3 Lithium is one, and Lithium Bank Calgary. Is another. Yeah.
And Lithium Bank is Vancouver, right?
Both the Vancouver and Calgary.
Okay, so you're in this Canadian connection of, makes a ton of sense.
Yeah, especially on applications like that, you really need to collaborate to talk about the different treatment methods and things that have happened.
I'd like to understand the company building as well, because you've started in the garage, and since the garage, you're the technical brain of the company, if I get it right. How did you team up on the business side of things? And if I'm right, along the way, you had some changes on the business or CEO side of things, and how does that affect the path of a pretty young company like yours?
Well, I decided early on, I made a few mistakes. I'd made a lot of mistakes when starting off the company. That cost me dearly. I owned a previous company before where it was pretty easy. I flipped in 3 years. I thought, with Swirltex, this is going to be even easier. This is a great idea. 5 years, I'm going to be on a beach sipping coconuts and my life's set. I literally had that thought in my head. And it's been a bit of a crazy story where when I came back from Antarctica, I had a consulting contract and life was good. Wasn't really looking for investment quite there, but the company that I was doing consulting for wanted to invest in us. And I thought it was good. I had everything set. I barely even tried. I was like giving myself fist bumps in the mirror. Life is good. And it was the elections in 2016 where the markets crashed after the election. And I thought, oh, maybe this is going to affect my investor. It didn't affect my investor at all. But as soon as I started looking to it, he wasn't in a position to invest at all. And he was in dire straits financially. And it took a lot of effort to undo that, not just physically, mentally, everything, where I ended up being penniless afterwards. I was actually homeless. Things were like really, really bad. I went from being super comfortable to like things were so bad. I was stealing food, just the bottom of my life. And we were lucky that we got a grant through Alberta Innovate to build the first pilot. So it was like, okay, figure it out. And we did an incubator. This is where I really started to get outside help on the business side of it. It was called the Creative Destruction Labs, where it was kind of like the Shark Tank thing, except they do a lot more coaching. It was absolutely fantastic program where I ended up meeting Melanie there, where she was doing her MBA. And I knew that I wanted to concentrate on the technical, the business development, and really not, you know, run around doing the raises, things like that. So if Melanie wanted to come aboard, and then I had Melanie aboard to kind of do the business administration infrastructure. Melanie was absolutely fantastic. I really can't say enough about her at all. Especially in this industry, it's a very hard industry for a young woman to take a dominant role. And she did absolutely fantastic, especially when she hasn't done raises or anything like that before. She's learning. And then when Melanie moved on and Rob stood in, it was a change. Definitely, it was a change in experience and leadership and a lot of different ideas. I think it's hard for a founder to let go of that control. And I think in a situation like that, it's always key that you have a really good board, a really experienced board. Because if you as a founder say, this is what I'm really good sales, I'm really good technically, that's where I bring the most value to the business. It's important that you have a spectrum of experienced people to make sure that the business decisions are the right decisions moving forward.
You mentioned your board. I guess you must have your investors on the board. So maybe I'd like to understand that one as well. You've been raising, you told the story of your first round with the angels, I guess. And then you had Mazarin coming on board for the venture round. So how do you interact with your investors?
I'm actually really close with my investors. Just because my life was in such dire situation when we did this CDL, like I was sleeping on a friend's couch and people still put the faith to invest in me. And I'm the type of person where, you know, I'm shown an ounce of kindness and I take it to heart. And I have some investors that I still go out with lunch with. I ask them for advice all the time, really try to get them involved as possible because they're a big part of the story. You know, they've been a big part of how Swirltex was formed, how it recovered, where we are now. And I'd like to make sure that my investors are excited about the possibilities and know what's going on. Definitely really close from our investors from the CDL side. Now that we have such a plethora of investors and we have a lot of small investors and things like that too. I haven't had the chance to meet all of our investors, but our key investors that came on at the beginning, all they're extremely close with.
What I'm interested also is to understand the grit and the resilience, because you mentioned how you went through that low where the conjuncture was against you, the timing was against you. A lot of outside elements you can't control are against you. And on the same time, you've proven in the past that in a different job, in a different vertical, you can do well. So aren't you tempted to just say, okay, I gave it a shot, didn't work, let me do something else?
Yes. When things were really bad, yeah. Just because it didn't spark out yet, right? It wasn't even a thing. And it was more of me saying, if I let it go, I am going to be 75 dying of cancer in my bed, just with nothing but regrets, right? And I said that I have to finish this. I have to give it my all. I'm good enough hands-on technically that I knew there was something really special about it. And if it wasn't that good, I wouldn't have stuck with it. Just because in our industry, especially with membranes, people haven't done something different and unique with membranes in a long time. It's stayed very stagnant. And if you get like a 20 or 40% increase in flux in membranes, that would be huge. The fact that we're easily getting 100% increase in flux and doing that using 70% less energy was always stuck. I didn't even know that was going to be 70% less energy. I just knew the increase in flux. I stuck, even during COVID, I was living on a cot in a crawl space above our office. And then I was like, okay, we're making progress. I'm doing this. It wasn't a matter of, okay, I want to quit. It was a matter of how long can I last for? I always say that being an entrepreneur is like running a marathon where you don't know where the end's going to be. And it sucks your energy. It sucks your stamina. It sucks your money, your livelihood. Don't get a girlfriend. But the thing is, you can't concentrate on running and you can't concentrate on the finish line. Instead, you just have to enjoy the process and enjoy that you're going for a run.
If we fast forward to 2022, which we touched on with this full scale with ARC, and to where you are today, it seems like it was worth running because it spectacularly took off. I mean, I found the figure for 2022 with a 10x in revenue. I didn't find the figures for 2023. Did you keep up that 10x pace or?
Yeah, we've been doubling. Since then, we've really been doubling our revenue every year. And I think we're going to be tripling it in 2025, which is nice. The good thing about our membranes are really high capacity. Like our standard train does 1,000 cubic meters a day. So it doesn't take many of these big jobs to really get going. And because we're concentrating on industries, industrial industries, the POs happen much faster. I was just almost straight municipal or remote camps, but industrials projects where they have that pain point, that problem, and you have a solution, it's a lot quicker. So it's a lot easier to build up the revenue.
Revenue is one thing, but are you profitable today?
We'll break even this year. And I would rather us just spend money than break even right now. But at the same time, we are going through a raise round right now or going through a raise. So we have to be a little bit careful about what we spend.
So when do you expect to close that round?
Hopefully by the end of April.
So 2022, 10x, 2023, 2x, 2024, 2x, and you foresee 2025, 3x, you're on the path to be a unicorn. My question is, what are you building?
I'd like to build a membrane company that really changes the aspects of what we can do with membranes. I feel that membranes are going to change drastically in the next 10 to 15 years. Everybody in the industry is really going with these turbulence promoters and membranes. You see it with Pentair, you see it with Ox. And the reason why is because they work. They really, really work. But the key is if you have that cross flow directly on the membrane, down the length of the membrane without a turbulence promoter, it really makes a difference. And you see this trend a lot with vortex membranes, et cetera, where the people are figuring out it's not so much the membrane, but how you use it, which is the really important thing. I think it's going to change just like we had, everything was packing density at one point. What's the packing density of your membrane? Nobody really cares about that. I think in the future, it's going to be how well are you using the surface area that you have instead of throwing as much in there as humanly possible. It's what is your flux and how are you actually using that surface area a lot more efficiently?
Membranes have a lot of perks. And I would agree with you that something's happening and something is on the verge of happening even bigger. But membranes have a major downsize, usually, I mean, the other side of the same coin, which is manufacturing for high volumes is a big investment and a lot of capex, which you have to immobilize in your assets. So what are your plans for that? Do you solve it fully with the fact that you're sourcing the membranes for your two suppliers, or do you still need to build up manufacturing capabilities?
We are just sticking with the strategy from our two suppliers and not building up our internal manufacturing capabilities. We still use our OEM and fabricators to build our skids, like our main membrane trains, but we have no plans to build the membranes ourselves. We're going to stick with the manufacturers that we have just because it's a lot faster. It's better financially to have somebody else manufacture those membranes, especially when they have the expertise to do so. And the financials for us to manufacture our own membranes here in North America just aren't there yet on the volumes that we are selling.
So North America is one thing, but what do you see on the midterm? Would you go worldwide or would you double down on what you know best?
Definitely, I think doing more projects in the States within the next few years is definitely going to be happening. Right now, a lot of our projects have been in Western Canada. We do have one in Eastern United States, but I think after 2025, really branching out, especially in the oil and gas plays in the Middle East, and really taking that technology and finding those channel partners in different geographic areas that can incorporate the membranes into the standard systems.
If anyone doubted the fact that you're setting yourself up for spectacular growth, on your website, I spotted 9 job openings. So how many people work for Swiltex today? And how big of a company are you in 5 years?
Right now, we have less than 10 employees. I think we have 8 employees overall.
So you're doubling the company.
We easily need to double our employees, our staff, to keep up with the work that we have. Minimum. One of the ways that we're really trying to combat that staff shortage that we have is finding channel partners that will use our membranes in the projects to do the project management and everything around it. That's been one way to keep the momentum going, being able to sell a product without having that infrastructure around it to support it, using these OEMs that, you know, have the operators, have the commissioning staff, etc., to really kind of help us out. And then they supply a lot of the equipment for the project as well.
Last question for me in that deep dive. It's a bit of a crystal ball question. If you look 5 years, 10 years down the line, what do you want to build and what will tell you that you had an impact?
That's a tough one. That's one that my kids always ask too. They're like, what is this going to do to others? Is this going to make an impact? Is it going to be worth it? Because they're very, very green kids that want to see the water reuse aspect of it. And I think for me on the technology, the ball is rolling now. And I think for me, after all the sacrifices and hardships that I kind of went through, I've kind of changed my perspective on what I'd like to see. And a lot of it is using the product to be able to justify everything that you kind of went through. And it has to be more than money. It has to be being able to sit down with my kids and say, look, this is the news clipping of where we recycled the water here. And even in the produced water side of it is showing, you know, that water would have gone to waste. And now we're being able to reuse that water. So I hope the technology leaves a legacy of water reuse and a different way of really kind of looking at membranes, really that legacy of understanding the hydraulics and seeing what other products or processes really spin off from what we're doing as well.
Well, Peter, it's been a pleasure. Thank you a lot for the openness in that deep dive and for sharing that fascinating path. I told you that I was expecting to be fascinated and I was beyond what I expected. If that's fine for you, I'd switch to the rapid fire questions.
It's time for the rapid fire questions.
What is the toughest challenge in your opinion for a water tech startup?
Keeping it simple.
What would be your best single piece of advice for the founders and managers of the about 1,000 early stage water startups?
Concentrate to what you're the best at.
How do you know at what you're the best at?
If you don't know what you're the best at, then that's the first question. Figure out what you're the best at.
That's a very good one. What's a drop of knowledge you wish more investors knew about the water sector?
The time that usually it takes to do these. These are multi-million dollar projects and they take years sometimes to plan out and not just somebody writing the check.
What was your most unexpected partnership and what did it bring you?
I think my most unexpected partnership was when I met Melanie at the CDO, and I knew that I needed a CEO because I screwed up so bad on the last investor snafu. That was probably one of the most unexpected partnerships and probably one of the most beneficial companies that we've had as well.
Super short, profitability or growth?
Growth. You have to spend money to make money. And in a situation like this, I mean, you should get times two on the money that you're spending to build that infrastructure out, definitely.
And yet you're expecting to become profitable this year. So you're not following.
I know. We need more money to be able to spend it. Like I said, it's the raising round where we just have to be careful with the timing.
What's the next profile you'll hire?
I would give a kidney for a senior process engineer. I'll be on the record for that.
I thought we were paying with money in the sector, but now we're paying with kidneys.
You'll get money too. But anything I can do to get one at this point in time.
When you hire, do you look for sector experience or startup experience?
Sector experience.
Opening new markets or doubling down on the current ones?
Doubling down on the current ones.
What's that tool nobody speaks about, but you couldn't live without?
Grammarly.
That would be mine. I thought I was alone, but apparently I'm not.
Absolutely changed my life. Yeah.
What's the single piece of insight your ideal customer profile needs to hear right now?
Just how we've made membrane simple. We really have, it's a complicated process, but we've done it in a simple way. And just because we've done it from an operator's perspective as well, a lot of the old things that weren't really thought about have been corrected.
What are you desperately needing and want to raise an open call for right now?
Senior process engineer. Staff, if Swirltech sounds like something that you want to get behind, that you want to be on this fun adventure with this startup, doing things process-wise that you don't get the freedom to do normally as an engineer, send me an email, call me, I will definitely answer.
When you answer twice the same and two different questions, that means that's really the one which is top of mind. I really, really underline that one.
Not to sound desperate, but yeah.
Last one, what can and should I do for you?
I really love your investment pages on YouTube where you talk about the different companies and how they're doing, especially with like NX filtration. You know, you've done it twice and it's one of my favorite because you don't get that anywhere else in the industry whatsoever. I would love to be part of I'd love for Swirltech to be a part of that conversation just to track its kind of unicorn status because we've had such a crazy startup. It would be such a great story when we kind of make it. It would be great to have us as part of that conversation as well.
I'd be delighted to. So sounds like we need to mark our calendars because at the pace you're at, that should happen 2025.
Sounds good. Yeah. October 2025 will be like a crazy time for us for sure.
Checked my calendar. I'm open in 2025 in October. So that's set. Peter, it's been a pleasure. If people want to follow up with you, for instance, if they are senior process engineers and they want to reach out, what's the best place to reach out to you?
Without giving you guys my full email address right now, just reach out through the website, submit your resumes, or if you want to get a hold of me through LinkedIn, you can too. I try to answer questions and inquiries through there as much as possible as well.
As usual, the links are in the description. I will find also that job offer for the senior process engineer and put it in the description. That way we have a full run on that one. Peter, it's been a pleasure. I'm super happy and looking forward October 2025 to have the sequel to that one. I hope our paths will cross in between because that's still quite far in the future. And yeah, thanks a lot.
Well, thank you. It's been an honor and I really look forward to talking to you again.
So what can we learn from Peter's roller coaster of a ride he just shared? Well, quite a lot, if you ask me. Starting with these 7 insights I wrote down, and number 1, navigating market entry. Breaking into established markets is tough, especially when incumbent favorites dominate. Swirltech carved its niche by targeting less saturated applications where traditional technologies fell short. Peter puts it best.
When I say that, it's hard to get into the municipal market where you have incumbent favorites. What we've tried to do is we've used membranes in areas like produce water treatment, mining, food and beverage, where membranes really haven't been successful. And those have been the easiest applications for us.
This approach not only made room for innovation, but also allowed them to showcase their unique value proposition. And if there's one strategy you shall steal today, it's probably this one. Then to execute it, you'll want to go to number 2, collaboration and partnerships. No company is an island, particularly in the water tech sector. For Swirltech, finding the right allies was crucial to scaling their technology. Peter emphasizes the importance of this strategy.
So especially since we're using a new process, it's important for us to really kind of prove out the technology in that market. But because we're such a small company too, we're really now trying to find channel partners that would pair with us to help us out with everything else around the membranes.
This insight underlines the power of partnerships in overcoming resource limitations and enhancing market reach. Do what you're best at and team up for the next bricks in the wall. Number 3, embrace serendipity in R&D. Sometimes the biggest breakthroughs come from unexpected places, as I alluded to in the full podcast intro. For Swiltex, a game-changing improvement came from an accidental tweak during a routine test. Peter recounts.
And then as soon as I added air, and I added air by accident, it really, like, it was immediate. It wasn't like, oh, it's a 10% increase. It was a huge increase in flux and performance.
This serendipitous discovery highlights the importance of flexibility and openness to new ideas in research and development. Sometimes you have to give that weird thing a try. Number 4, perseverance through hardship. Entrepreneurship is not for the faint of heart. Peter's journey included extreme lows, which tested his resolve, but ultimately reinforced his commitment to his vision. He shares,
and it was more of me saying, if I let it go, I am going to be 75 dying of cancer in my bed, just with nothing but regrets, right? And I said that I have to finish this. I have to give it my all. I'm good enough hands-on technically that I knew there was something really special about it. And if it wasn't that good, I wouldn't have stuck with it.
This powerful testament is a reminder that true grit often leads to lasting impact. Number 5, take bold risk with applications. Deploying a new technology in one of the most remote and harsh environments on Earth, Antarctica, was a bold move by Swiltex. This leap of faith not only proved the technology, but also set a high bar for its potential. Peter describes the experience.
And having an opportunity like that was a bit of a stretch, but traveled down there and we're short on time. It didn't think that we'd do it, but the actual process worked not just a little bit good, but really, 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 really well. And we were able to hit our nutrient removal targets that we were looking at.
Such daring moves can be transformative, proving that high risks sometimes lead to high rewards. Number 6, leadership and team dynamics. The evolution of a startup often necessitates shifts in leadership to suit the changing landscape of the business. For Swiltex, this meant bringing in a CEO to complement the founder's technical expertise. Peter discusses these dynamics.
I had Melanie aboard to kind of do the business administration infrastructure. Melanie was absolutely fantastic. And then when Melanie moved on and Rob stood in, it was a change. Definitely, it was a change in experience and leadership and a lot of different ideas. I think it's hard for a founder to let go of that control. And I think in a situation like that, it's always key that you have a really good board, a really experienced board. Because if you as a founder say, this is what I'm really good sales, I'm really good technically, that's where I bring the most value to the business. It's important that you have a spectrum of experienced people to make sure that the business decisions are the right decisions moving forward.
Adapting leadership roles and embracing fresh perspectives can be crucial for growth and innovation. And number 7, impact over profit. For many entrepreneurs, the drive to make a difference is what fuels their business more than the bottom line. Peter's reflection on this shift in perspective is moving.
I think for me, after all the sacrifices and hardships that I kind of went through, I've kind of changed my perspective on what I'd like to see. And a lot of it is using the product to be able to justify everything that you kind of went through. And it has to be more than money. It has to be being able to sit down with my kids and say, look, this is the news clipping of where we recycled the water here. And even in the produced water side of it is showing, you know, that water would have gone to waste and now we're being able to reuse that water. So I hope the technology leaves a legacy of water reuse and a different way of really kind of looking at membranes, really that legacy of understanding the hydraulics and seeing what other products or processes really spin off from what we're doing as well.
It's a powerful reminder that the ultimate measure for success is the positive impact on society. I'd say that each of these insights from Swiltex's journey offers valuable lessons on navigating the complexities of entrepreneurship in the water sector. They highlight the blend of passion, innovation, and strategic thinking necessary to not only survive, but thrive in this, as you know it, demanding field. Anyways, there you have it, my 7 insights from Peter Christou in under 7 minutes. If you disagree with my selection, tell me. And if you'd like to dive deeper, well, listen to the full interview. Remember, that episode came to you free of charge, but I would believe not free of value. It takes me quite some time to put all of those together every week, so all I'm asking is for you to help me distribute them. Take this episode, share it with a friend, a colleague, your boss, or your team, and I'll be back with another one next week.
Thanks for listening to Don't Waste Water. This podcast was brought to you by GF Piping Systems. Loved this episode? Head over to Apple Podcasts to subscribe, rate, and leave a review. See you next time.